well, not all of us do this, but I recognize that very many people feel as though, boy, I can hear the tension in me because there's so much I want to get done today. That the part that comes first is inspired, and they're skeptical about, you know, touching that and so on. Well, those are generally called free poems. I don't think I started that word up. And most poets, if they're honest, will tell you that they don't give very many free poems, you know, where it's done or almost done the first time. If I had a handful, you know, in these years, it would surprise me. Those certainly aren't the epic poems. Those certainly aren't, you know. I sometimes use the analogy of what scale is a poem seen to be, and if you could compare it to visual arts, like some poems are sketches, you know, and then other poems are charcoal pieces, and other poems are full-blown paintings, and then some poems are like wall-sized murals, and some poems are like, you know, stained glass windows that really have a huge intent, and they're big poems, and they're quite complicated, and so on. So you've got that whole range of what the poem, what suggests to us how big a poem ought to be, or how long, you know, we ought to work on it, or how many revisions it ought to have. Well, I think a part of that is, you know, the subject matter, our feel for it, our expertness at it. When we're doing something, as we were doing the other day, we're remembering how much recall do we have, what in process recall do we discover that we didn't have, you know, before. And that so often happens with us that we start with a bit of a memory there, and then you've found this out already, some of you, that before you know it, you know, you're remembering more and more and more and more, and it was all triggered by that one image of a sight, or the sound of the cash register, or the smell of the sawdust, or, you know, whatever it was, begins to link a bunch of stuff, and you get these kind of stacked memories. How accurate they are, I can't say. I've been reading a lot lately about memory, and I just don't know. I was reading Borges, South American poet, the other day, and he says, when I remember a thing, I'm not really remembering the thing, I'm remembering the last time I remembered the thing. Uh-huh. And so that has a lot of implications too, you know, as we grow older and remember it at the more distance and so on. Well, nobody wanted to read anything immediately, so we'll just plow ahead then. Today's session is called Writing from the Outside In, and I thought I would try to locate you with something as a kind of writing. Never are you supposed to write, you know, by the example it's given or whatever, but it's just a way to kind of, maybe I won't have to say quite so many words about it, if I can, you know, illustrate it with a piece of the sort that I might have been thinking about when I made up that title. I'm always happy after I've made up titles for sessions, because then it helps me, you know, be less disingenuous and stuff. I mean, it makes me actually get some form about it. But when making up the title, I hate the process, and I wish they wouldn't ask for it. This one's called Riddles of the Water and the Ride. And let's see. We can talk about the neighborhood later. But for now, I would invite you to listen for two things only. Prepositions and sensory information. Smell, sight, sight, touch, hearing. And then we don't have to discuss this a lot, but we can sort of talk a little bit about it if it needs be. We'll talk about how we write from the outside in. And the Japanese end up saying a traditional word, not contemporary word, because now the Japanese write all kinds of word, but a traditional word. I mean, after you drop an atomic bomb on a couple of cities, then I think you get pretty surreal, and so they work a lot in surrealism now. But traditionally, they felt that the only proper subject was nature. Of course, they consider the poet to be a part of nature, so it's, you know, there is that inclusion. Riddles of the Water and the Ride. I can hear the river, and I can hear the rain tease 10 roofs. I smell the dark, wet lumber stacked new cut beside the only road. and taste brown bitter coffee cooling in the morning air. I sit in oaken captain's chair high on the porch, feet upon the rail. Geraniums bloom red on leafy green below in yellow boxes neatly set at windowsills. A hammer rings over in the shed. Some kerchiefed girl strides off to make the bed's hugging linen, white and warm yet, from the dryers in the basement up the hill. Maynard starts the truck and backs her down the road. Fog slips up the valley, meeting snow left forgotten in the pockets of the peaks. Small birds whistle from small pines, and small boys test small puddles with small feet. The carpenter waits a moment beneath the porch roof, tries the leather gloves, and steps out into the rain, coming just a little harder now. Eaves drip, the breeze picks up a bit, the window slams against the morning cold. A couple strolls by down on the walk, deep inside themselves in quiet talk I can't quite hear. And Jack and Becky slip from porch to porch, sharing the black umbrella brought from town. And half an hour later, I still hear the river, fuller, wild, and wide, and 1,000 raindrops join her. They ask, and river answers, those mountain morning riddles of the water and the ride. Did you catch a lot of location stuff, prepositional stuff? Mm-hmm. The speaker in the poem, which is pretty nearly me, but we don't always want to confuse an I poem, first person poem, as being precisely the poet. But this speaker is pretty much like me, and this event is pretty much like an event that happened to me. It's what I mean when I say it's all fiction anyway, finally, you know. Did these incidents happen? Well, yeah, a lot of them, most of them did. Yeah, I think pretty much all of them did, you know. Were they slightly different? Well, I think it was somewhat more than 1,000 raindrops joining the river. I think it was like a bazillion, you know. I didn't need to remain true to the bazillion, because bazillion would sound, you know, absolutely preposterous. So I didn't say 100,000 million, you know, raindrops joining the river. We get the idea that it takes on sort of colloquialism. So the speaker's kind of like me. And what are all these prepositions doing in there? What's the function of that?
Well, I think they have depth. I like, you know, like use beneath them, and it gives you a sense of place. Mm-hmm.
Where is the speaker sitting?
On a porch.
Okay.
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah, it could have been. I don't remember exactly which one, but I believe that it's, I can't remember now, this has been a while, but I believe it says high upon porch. Might be second floor, I think it was. Okay. And then, where are the dryers?
Right.
Up the hill. Okay. And where's the, where does Maynard back the truck? Down the road. Mm-hmm. Fog slips up the valley. Okay. Carpenter waits a moment beneath the porch roof, as I mentioned. So all of these things are, in other words, when you use prepositional phrases, it's a handy way to locate the speaker. Where is the speaker in the neighborhood? Okay. There's stuff happening up here that I notice. There's stuff down there I notice the speaker's saying. There's something that caught my attention here. There's a person going down from the laundry hugging this warm linen on a cold day. You know, coming down the hill from the laundry that's up in the basement. You know, da 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 da. So you're getting, you know, stuff that's, you know, that the speaker's attention is caught by. And so you get an outside that the speaker is very much in the middle of. but so that's why today is called Writing the Outside In. And that's what we're going to be encouraged to do here in a bit, is we're going to have to kind of do it with a memory, I think, but we'll do a warm-up that'll just be sort of like right here where we are. But, you know, how to write from the outside in, and what practice, what function that might have. The subtitle is At Peace. This is a poem in which, for my part, I feel that the speaker's at peace. Speaker's not moving anywhere. Speaker's not skipping from porch to porch trying to stay out of the rain. The speaker's not backing the truck down the only road. The speaker's not walking out of the land. The speaker has the leisure to be sitting with a cup of coffee scribbling, you know, and just sort of absorbing and taking it all in, and a lot of sensory information there too, as much to get.
A comment, interesting use of gender. The car is a, the truck is a her, and the river's a her also. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I grew up with so many trucks that we always, tractors that we always called. I'm trying to think if anything around the farm was called bigger stuff. I guess real big, ugly stuff was called by the masculine. Yeah. Manure spreaders. Seeders and hay balers and stuff. Dusty, disgusting, besotted things were. Spoken. I mean, it's kind of like a ship, isn't it? You call it a ship that. Okay, so that's, you know, that's enough about me. Let's talk about us. To do a warm-up today, I would invite you to use, and of course you notice that you localize some central sensory information out here. Taste of the coffee, smell of this, the sight of that, the color of the geraniums, the color of the box, the color of the leaves, colors of the laundry in the basket, da-da-da-da-da. There's like a lot of visual and smell and taste information coming in. Now, as a warm-up for this kind of thing, we can locate ourselves right here and just do this. We'll just take 60 seconds, and we'll use just one sense only, and we'll have plenty of stuff to work with, believe me. I mean, we don't have to be in an inner-city school, you know, on a boulevard in order for this to crackle. Just jot down, as a list, you don't have to make sentences or anything, all the stuff you hear in the next 60 seconds. And when you think you've dried up, then listen one notch deeper and see what else you hear, you know? You've probably done that kind of thing before. So let me put the ones on there, let me see the little bit of second hand on this little watch. Well, and again, we're just riding as fast as we can. I'm trying to cover a lot of ground here. I'm the only guy in the room that doesn't have a pencil already. Okay. Timer and lighter. Okay, ready? Go. Full stop. Okay, I don't feel bad about seeing if anybody wants to read from this, because it's not that personal. First of all, just count how many entries you have. I'll confess, I have 17. Who's got more than that?
20.
How many?
20.
20? Okay.
Did you just want noises, like river? Like...
Exactly.
Okay.
Did I instruct you wrong? I think I may have.
No, I interpreted wrong.
Oh, sorry. Yikes. Okay, anybody
care? I flowered the noises of war.
Oh!
I did
right.
Too.
I only got five.
Sorry. Yeah, here's what mine looks like. I guess this one has some of the flowered stuff on it, you know, some of the descriptive flowered stuff on it. Anybody care to read theirs? Shoot, you're the winner, you got 20.
I might have made up.
And it's your birthday, and I haven't wished you a happy birthday.
Wish
you a time or two. Shall we sing?
Yeah, both of us.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Joanne. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you very much.
That's a big one.
I have
actually two.
I'll hear both. I like different. Singing different.
Rock and roll from the pottery shop.
A hammer, footsteps, children's voices, the creek, laughter,
a water fountain,
a baby,
a door, birds. I think I made that one up. I thought that was good.
The birds?
Yeah, I know they're out there.
It's good enough to hear it anymore. Yeah. Hear it.
A conversation.
Now African music from the pottery shop. More footsteps. Wind in the trees. I made that up too because it's not windy today. So
I don't think you did make it up, actually.
I didn't make it up. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I'll
say that.
All right.
Mostly through my ears.
Come on. Wood creaking in the floor. My neighbor's pen right in here. And clear in her throat. Paper crackling. A cough. Laughter.
Good. Terrific. Anybody got something that she didn't mention?
My own breathing.
Your own breathing.
Yeah. And that was
low hum like a high-flying plane there towards the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought I heard an airplane.
Yeah.
I haven't
sure
heard
an airplane.
Children playing, they're out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I heard hands moving across the notebooks.
Yeah.
Moving my own notebook on my lap.
Yeah, paper sounds and notebooks. Yeah.
A baby. And I heard wind blowing the leaves. It was just like a burst. And I just heard the leaves once. And chairs crackling. The chairs were making sounds. Mm-hmm.
I put my arm down once and my jewelry clattered. Did you get that?
Yeah.
Isn't that really?
Yeah.
I relocated on the page and did some kind of sound. Any others? Well, not to belabor it then. So, you know, in one of the quietest places that human beings hang out, you know, on the planet, it's got lots of sounds in one little space of 60 seconds. Mm. You know, I'll remind you again that tells us that there is never a time that we cannot write. Mm. There is not ever a time that is silent around us. One time, not quite 20 years ago, I think I heard silence, and it was so shocking to me that I thought I was hearing silence. And I kept thinking about it and listening for it to see if it really was silence. I took on insomnia and I could not sleep. You know, trying to divine whether or not this was actual silence or some sort of, you know, there's got to be a sound out there somewhere. It didn't seem to be. So this is a pretty interesting place. You know, the world's a pretty interesting place. This room is, the universe is. You know, I think that it's by our ability to, somehow we have this ability to be bored or to expect the usual. I think it's, you know, maybe like some sort of, I think it's not in the Constitution, I don't think, but I think it probably is like a God-given right. I think it's probably in Leviticus somewhere or something, you know, for you to say, I'm bored, or that bored me. But you know, especially from classrooms, that the students always phrase it how?
This is boring.
This is boring. It's boring. And so on. And then we even ask questions so that we get bad information. We say, how was the movie? It's okay. It's kind of boring. Yeah. Well, see, and so then we don't go. We make a decision based on this information. And we should have said, how did you feel about the movie? Well, I was bored. See, that causes them to own the information, to own that opinion. So the way we language, now we're kind of getting into, how do you language speech so that you can be responsible to yourself and other people, you know? I don't think you can really write genuinely responsible writing unless you're also in the habit of trying to speak and listen responsibly too, and also be a worthy reader. There are four, you know, language arts, reading, writing, talking, and listening. In all cultures, they happen in the same order. You learn to listen first, and from that you learn to talk, and then you learn to read, and then you learn to write. And it doesn't matter what culture you have, if it's got writing, that's the way it happens. And then there's also sort of a world of imagination, but we can't measure that, so we don't talk about it in schools or anything. And so those are the things we've got to work with, and I think there's such a link. Well, of the four that I just mentioned, two are information going out, two are information going in, right? So you got talking and writing are information going out, reading and listening are information going in. And I can't see how, if we're trying to write, we're interested in information going out, if we're not also very, very interested in the other information going out system we have, which is talking. You know, I know a lot of poets, very gifted ones and people of you know, large standing, and not a one of them talks in a way that is sort of civilian talk. You know, they all have very infectious ways of talking. And if I do you any good today, part of it will be because I'm trying to be faithful to the method in which I'm choosing speech. You know, there's a lot in our world and our society and our institutions that encourages us to talk like everybody else. Why? So we don't stand out. You know, so we don't say anything memorable. And after a while, with that kind of thing going on, then we begin not to notice anything memorable. And then pretty soon we think there's nothing going on. And then pretty soon we say, it's boring. I'm bored. Oh, well, I'm so bored, I can't write. I have nothing to write about. You know, I'm not interesting. I don't have any interesting thoughts. I'm not in an interesting place. If I were in France now, then I could write. Well, you know, my notion is we write where we are, we write out of what we have, and we write, you know, from the outside in. We write in this room. You know, we write from the stuff that's just right here. Because, just real quickly, you know, this, we met in here yesterday, that was in the morning, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we all found our ways back to here, which is amazing to me, because this room is not where we left it. You know, the globe itself turns at something about 1,000 miles an hour, so that, you know, it says every hour since we left, it's gone 1,000 miles. And then it's also been shooting down through space, at great speed. So this room is thousands and thousands of miles from where we left it. But we sort of slouched in here and sit down and say, ah, same room, I feel comfortable. So, you know, it's not even, you know, that's amazing to me. You know. On the micro level, I'm fascinated by when does a particular kind of food become body? I think that's kind of a religious moment, you know. With potatoes and starches and stuff, it actually starts with an enzymatical reaction in our mouth. With other kinds of stuff, it doesn't happen to go down farther, and then somewhere it goes up. But how does, you know, how does your body know to make green pepper into, you know, this, and to make hot dog into hair and fingernails, and to make, you know, there's some point in which it's not hot dog, it's fingernails, you know, it's not cheese anymore. So, you know, those kinds of things. Well, I'm kind of getting into tomorrow, where I'm, you know, we're talking about writing from the inside out, but. You know, there are loads and loads of things to be writing about and be absorbed in, absorbed with which to be absorbed. So that's just one easy sort of warm up for, you know, kind of a, how to do that bit. Now I'd ask you to combine yesterday and today in the same way. And for those of you who weren't here yesterday, I can say this to you in about 30 seconds. What we did yesterday was just take one memory from any time. As long ago or as recently as happened to us, and I just put that on a page in something like sentences, but also sentence fragments and lists and whatever else. There come junctures where we sort of do find ourselves, as you say, kind of dressing it up a bit, and there are some other junctures where we're not. We're just trying to get down as much stuff as is possible. But if we could sort of wed that notion of a memory, seize upon that, and get with the outside world very much in the manner of this little grocery store that happened yesterday. Okay, I would emphasize sensory information, you know, information that is certainly the speaker's right to interpret and so on, but like somebody had conversation, I had a couple of different remarks about that. I had voices, later I had voice speech, later I had voice. So I didn't really hear it as a conversation. I guess, yeah, maybe I did. I think I thought maybe for a moment there was an exchange. But I certainly knew that it was somebody talking, but I couldn't really gather that if it was a monologue or or a dialogue, really. But you see what I'm saying? So I'll time this one, and Keith will be taking about 5 minutes here after I say the word go, the second time, not that time. We'll be writing. And so what we'll try to do is try to seize a memory and put in as much sensory information as we can, I would encourage you to consider, well, I will do that, I'm going to fix that in a second. Do it in the first person. Okay? I. First person singular. And I'll be doing it too, and then you will not have to read anything out loud if you don't care to, or I may not even ask anybody to. It just depends on how things go and what else occurs to me while we're doing that and so on. So do you have any questions about what's suggested here?
Can we write it in like, can we write it in like a present form, like it's happening to us again?
Yeah. Yeah. Good idea. Present memory, I love it. Yeah, present moment. Anything else? I think I'm on top. Okay. Let's go, campers. Go, Pete. Okay. Take a big stretch, take a couple of deep breaths, and after that, just scan down and eyeball the piece, see if you wrote down what you thought you wrote down. And as you do that, just read it interiorly to yourself. And there may be even be things that you want to make the lines. Well, here's the thing that happened to me while I was actually writing, was that as I was writing this sentence and got to here, I felt that this would sound good over here, so I just circled it through the mirror. So there could be things like that that you want to do that are not, that are revisionary, but not exactly major stuff. Jot down some words or little phrases that are coming to you now as you've kind of gotten involved with it here as a meeting thing to yourself. I'm doing it kind of right at the side here. Just kind of jotting down some other stuff by just simple words, single words or word, two words at a time that I think might get in there as I keep going with this sometime. Sometimes we get into that and go on for another 5 minutes or half an hour easily. Why don't you put that to one side, and I'll try to remember to get back to them in just a moment. But if I don't, well, don't be shattered. But what I want you to do is have some cooling off time with that thing, just for a little bit. Put some other words in your head, and then we'll come back to it in a little bit.
Gee, I'm going to run and get my journal things.
So. Oh, cool. Great. We'll be here another 20 minutes or so.
I'll be right back.
Okay. Okay, why don't we stand up and have a stretch and suck in a lot of oxygen so we can oxygenate the brain because it's been chewing it up like crazy. I find it helpful always to think about the physiological stuff of what goes on when we write. And we always know that we're using our eyes, we're using our hand, or we're using the keyboard and our fingers and so on. But there's other stuff going on. And it is, I mean, writers can sit there and, you know, numb out and have too little oxygen, let their legs go to sleep and, you know, stand up and fall over. I mean, a lot, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so we need every now and then to kind of refresh ourselves in order that we don't have to sit there. Nobody's tied our ankles to the chair legs with duct tape or anything, you know. We can move around a little bit, and it's probably good for the writing to do so. Let's see.
The first poem that you read that's yours, is that in the bookstore?
I don't know what it is.
Found more than your journal.
No, that's oh, what a wonderful journal you have there. It's from a book that's out of print. But thanks for asking about that. Okay, so now I've got a heap of stuff here beside Dan, so I can sit and copy it. Okay, so there are two reasons why I'm going to embark on what I'm going to embark on now. One of them is just to get some distance away from the piece that you just generated. Another one is to live out what I say, and that is, I mentioned to Teek the other evening, we were chatting about poetry and poetics and stuff, and to me it feels like this in my life, that as a poet, I'm always juggling writing poems and reading poems and other stuff, but a lot of contemporary poetry and so on, and I'll mention my method on that. In school, I think we went this way. We went back to the oldest poet they could find and translate, and then came forward slowly, 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 so that we finally got up to Longfellow. Or if we were really fortunate, Whitman, Emily Dickinson. And then, thankfully to the teachers, some of us there, so we could all go away and not think about that. Well, I commend to you the opposite way. Think of yourself as an archaeologist. Rather than say, this is what was read, and what, you know, what did that lead to? And what did that lead to? And where does Shakespeare get his ideas? That's more the way I want to speak, is where did this come from? Where did Shakespeare get his ideas? So start with stuff that was like written published last week. And once you feel you've got a grip on what's been going on the last couple of years, then I would say, well, okay, so figure out what those folks were reading. You know, go back and find out where their stuff came from. And then dig down another layer, archaeologists, and find out where that came from. Dig down another layer to find out where that came from. The reasons for that are that the concerns of the poets who were published last week are, you know, very much our concerns. You know, our political concerns, our social concerns, our love concerns, our family concerns, so on. And also the language is pretty much like our language. It's maybe a little better organized than our language, but it's, you know. And once we get a usedness to that, then we can sort of go back and feel happy with Whitman's language, which is a very different language, you know, only 150 years ago, than the language we operate with today. So that's just my little tip. So I'm going to try to live that out by actually reading some stuff for you. And then also, maybe the two can cross-pollinate, where maybe some of this stuff is going to hit you in some way that might infect what you just wrote. And then when I give you a little bit of time to sort of do some more listing and stuff with it, maybe something else will pop. So it's perfectly fine to, I think the nice word is borrow from other poets and so on. If it's more than five words, of course. You know, you're set up for a lawsuit, but I mean, five words in a string. But it's perfectly fine to borrow. I know other people call it steal. It's perfectly fine to be infected by and influenced by other writers. And so I'll just zing through a couple of these here without much remark and let us feel the weight of some really good writing. Mary Oliver, a lot of us like. This is... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, what we would call stanzas or word clumps. The second one has three lines, but all the others are two. and I just am absolutely knocked dead when I get out of the last two. I'm slap silly all the way through it, but I'm knocked dead when I get down there. It's called Rain in Ohio. I don't know what could be a more simple title. Rain in Ohio. It's another thing I'll mention, that if you want to pack something, use the shortest words you can get away with. Last time I looked, there were something like 58 meanings for the word run in the dictionary I consulted. So if you want something that has layered meanings, multiple meanings, or the chance of ambiguity of meaning, go with run. Rather than jog, marathon, you know, whatever, see. And you'll hit tame little words, you know, nothing very long. Rain in Ohio. The robin cries, rain. The crow calls, plunder. The black snake climbing in the vines halts his long ladder of muscle, while the thunderheads whirl up out of the white west, their dark hooves nicking the tall trees as they come. Rain, 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 sings the robin frantically, then flies for cover. The crow hunches. The black snake pours himself swift and heavy into the ground. Now, when we talk about poetry being something that's compressed so that we get that tension and that power behind the line, that's exactly what we're talking about. You could spend a great deal more time than the black snake pours himself swift and heavy into the ground, trying to describe this black snake going into the ground. And it might be a fruitful thing to be doing, you know, in another piece of writing. But here, isn't it? So absolutely perfect. We're set up with the first, you know, starting with the first word of the title, rain. What is the thing? A water image, rain, liquid, pouring, you know. We get a foreshadowing of that with the black snake climbing in the vines and halting his long ladder of muscle. So we already have a feeling for this undulation and all that goes on under the skin of a snake. Or if you've been in the desert and see where snakes go, and you can just see the different, especially sidewinders, it's just really astounding to see what sorts of mark they make across, out diagonally across your field of vision there. But this way in which that snake pours himself swift and heavy into the ground is worth the price of admission for me. So then, let's see. Now, I've said that but I haven't said it today, so I can get away with saying it again, that one of my functions, I feel, as a poet is to discover metaphor. I mean very, very much to say that I am not in the business of inventing metaphor. To me, invented metaphor is a stretcher, it's contrivance. And it's something that I want to winnow out of any piece of poetry that I have. You may use this analogy again. Let me use an analogy again, and this is this one. These are the kind of three principal directions of visual design: diagonal, vertical, horizontal. Horizontal is suggestive of repose. Vertical is suggestive of growth. Diagonal is suggestive of tension, anxiety, falling, change. And there could be more lists under each of these. A really fascinating one for me when I first began thinking about this is a set of stair steps seen in profile, which is the overall diagonal made up of about equal parts of vertical and horizontal. But see, when we've got something like this, well, okay, let's back up over here. This is what happens in a sofa painting, you know? We get a landscape, don't we? You know, and it's kind of somewhat like that. You know, and it's got some other stuff there. But the movement in it is generally horizontal. It suggests you're at home now, sit down, lie on the couch, look up at the painting, you know, sit on the other side of the room, etc. Well, this is a corn stalk. Okay, this is going somewhere. And everything that is shaped in that direction in our vision is you know, that. This, I mean, something's either falling down or it's being shoved up or, you know, something. So it's that now. These design elements are not, these are common to all cultures. Anybody with eyeballs discovers these in some form or another and uses them in some way or another on their pottery or on their anything that they handle and work with and make tools and so on. These are not contrivances. These are not inventions. This is just discovering design elements. And I'm saying that to me, in poetry, I'm using the analogy of visual art here, but in poetry, I'm trying to discover metaphors. Like one of the poems that I have begins, "Under clumps of lumpy snow along the road, the snow has become cauliflower." Now, if you've ever seen the kind of high desert of Nevada and stuff, the sage grows right down there, and then because it's kind of coming out, it looks like baby's breath, only great big. It looks like a, you know, and then it's, when the snow piles up on that, and it's all sort of a tan color. Anyway, it looks just like cauliflower to me one day when I was out in the blizzard. And then ever since then, it's looked like cauliflower to me. Now, I don't think that's a stretcher. You know, I don't think I have to really work hard to say it looks like that. I think it, you know, to me it just does look like that. So that's what I'm talking about. Well, so I have a strong feeling for the necessity of metaphor and the way, because I learn by it. And that's why I do art, is to learn. And but this is one from a friend of mine, he makes, his speaker in this poem presents sort of a devil's advocate posture. Makes a case for, non-metaphor and so on. And it's called Memory. I love the flat way in which Scott talks. I talked the other day about speaking poets and singing poets, and he's kind of a real speaking poet. This is good straight talk. "The problem with memory is that most memories are dull. What happens in general is mostly dull. I remember how dull my own boyhood was. The long wait for something to happen, nearly always ending in disappointment. Martha Watson's summer dresses nearly falling away, but never really falling away. But suppose one morning, without rain, she found her way to my room, the sun entering with her and lighting up the window and the bed, lighting up her dress as it became liquid and fell down her arms. I think that would be interesting. And her sad small breasts and her strong thighs lighted up would be interesting. I think I would find everything about her visit tremendously interesting. That's why even a little of this extravagance is so necessary. Why, in the strange and unlikely light of such visitations, the actual nearly always pales into embarrassment. It's too serious to want around. Too earnest to put up with for very long. Its straight face can turn laughter bitter in your mouth, choke the best parts of your past, ruin your life." That's a whole different way of talking about stuff in a very... So he's taken on the role of a character. That's not how Scott is or behaves or acts in the world or anything. But he's taken on a character there that would talk that way, and it has such a cohesion about it. You know, obviously it's artifice, because the character who really it would find life all that dull would have to really write a poem in the first place, etc. But that kind of construct is there. And let me see if I've got time to squeeze this one because it's tiny. And then I want to... Do you have time to stay over for like 3 minutes or 4 minutes, you think?
Sure.
Can we do that?
You got some appointments.
You've got, yes. Some errands to do, pick up the dry cleaning and...
What do we do?
Okay, this is called The New Road, and it's from a poet friend of mine named Dick Richard Shelton. And he has lived for many, many, many years in the... desert southwest around, lived near Tucson and spent a lot of time in the desert. A lot of alone time, a lot of meditative, reflective time that I think he would just call it sort of taking a rucksack and appropriate amount of water and just striking him. And he has been a person involved in like a lot of poets, he's not a very political man, but eventually your interest leads you into sort of political arenas or postures of some kind. This is called The New Road. Tonight, at the end of a long scar in the desert, a bulldozer sleeps with its mouth open like a great yellow beast. A coyote sits down to watch it from a safe distance. An owl questions again and again. No answer. Someone is building a new road. A fine road. Wide and smooth. The huge saguaros in its path have stood here 200 years looking up at the sky. This will be their last chance to see the moon. In the morning, the yellow beast will wake up and move toward them. We believe in movement. We live in the sanctity of mobile homes. We are children of those who created the portable Indian and moved him from place to place. Ours is a republic of cylinders and pistons, a republic of wheels. Progress moves before us over the hill, and we pursue it as fast as we can, with our horses in trailers, our politicians in limousines, and all our angels on motorcycles, we pursue it. The world rolls on, and these gods of the desert cannot get out of its way. They are no use to us. I have stroked them until my hands are bloody, but what comfort can I offer? They are doomed, and I am tired of being human, tired of being mad in a mad world. Now I lay me down in a new road, but to whom can I pray? The owl has stopped calling. The coyote gets up and fades away. I will look at the moon as long as I can. Then I will sleep in the desert, helpless in the path of progress, waiting for the sound of wheels. Now, I offer this one because it's got a whole bunch of sensory stuff, it's got a whole bunch of tangible images, it's got symbology in it, you know, the saguaro is a god in this, you know, the owl is a god, and this all takes its cue from Southwest religious notions, where the coyote is the trickster figure god who, you know, just when everything's going fine, well, he slips in and does something goofy and just for the sheer hell of it and fun of it, etc. And there is a section yet in which it's in three sections demarcated by these old-fashioned looking sort of units here, the names of which are not units, but I can't remember what they're called. And in this center section, he actually does pull back and get a bit preachy, doesn't he? You know, he just says, you know, we believe in movement. Flat statement. We live in the sanctity of mobile homes, okay, etc. Ours is a republic of cylinders and pistons, a republic of wheels. Okay. Now, it's interesting words he's choosing, and certainly interesting rhythms, and rhythms appropriate to the what he's trying to get to. But you know, but it's essentially, that's his sermon is in the middle. How can he get away with it? Probably because he's got a lot of rhythm going for him, and also because he's got a bunch of stuff set before and after that will say to us, well, this is still a poem, you know, this is not a political poster, you know. Like the old saying, nobody changed the world with a poster. You know, those people who are in love with it are people who already thought that way, you know. So, that's a thought. All right, now I'll pull back to your piece of paper, if you would. I'm just going to be really directed because we don't have as much time as I want, and you know that, and it makes me crabby, but there we are. And what I would invite you to do is, if you have a paper, you know, like so, but mine is like so. And so what I'm going to do is fold mine, well, I guess by thirds. Kind of by rough thirds.
A blank piece of paper?
Yeah, not the paper you wrote on. Yeah, thanks, I'm sorry. I'm not making myself clear this today. Now, we're going to pretend that we've all decided. See, the best way for this to happen would be a tutorial where I would work with each one of you individually for 2 hours at a chance and then berate you and make you go home and get potent and stuff and, you know, write purple poems. But that can't happen. So we're going to pretend that we've all come to the conclusion that what we've been writing earlier in the session, you know, is leading us to think that it wants to be a poem. Okay? How do you get it from, you know, something that is sentence fragments, sentences, it's almost lying on the page, like, you know, mine kind of runs out of steam over here, but, you know, it takes up a lot of the page, it's kind of almost like paragraphs. Why does mine stop about there? I think it's because of the rhythm, but I'd have to really look at it to check. About there, I feel like I want a line break because of this, whether the words have been going along. So what I'd like you to do would be to begin by circling your best shot within that body of work that you generated. It might be the first line that you're most attached to, or it might be well down into it, I don't know. And then transfer that to the center portion only of your folded paper. So what we're going to do is skinny these hummers down so that they are running right down the center of the page, so that they're shaped like many of contemporary poems. There is a movement now towards sort of a longer line in poetry, and of course we all know about prose poetry and, you know, those places where prose and poetry meld and so on and so on. But right now we're just going to work and say, you know, we're going to have about 3 or 4 beats to the line, because it's only going to basically fit within that center section. And then I would say, after you've written that first good chunk that you have there, fish around in there just like you would, you know, fishing in a duck pond or a barrel or a horse trough or something, and see what else you catch out of here that you want to put in that center bar. Am I making any sense?
Are we just picking snatches, or are we trying to make a linear, or a, you know, have it make sense with each other?
I don't quite want to answer that, but I will. Mm-hmm. I think that what you write first will guide you into the right place to help you feel comfortable and happy and like you're creating something. And that's what I'd like you to do, is create something. And you can also pull from your list that you began to generate over here stuff that seemed like it might want to work its way in there sometime. So
we're right in this middle.
Yeah.
The middle of the middle?
Well, just use the two edges there on the two folds as your margins.
So it can be anywhere in here.
So you're saying that when you write, however form you're ending up with, that an essence that should be kind of a stanza.
Oh no, I'm just building a contrivance here to cause us to not go on and on and on.
Okay.
It'll force us into trying to sort of, squeeze it down. Because, you know, sometimes when I get jammed up when I'm writing, I don't have the screen this way, or I don't have the paper in the typewriter that way. I turn it the other way, so I can write even longer lines, you know. Well, this isn't that time, this is the reverse, you know, where we're being encouraged to, you know, to compromise a bit and smooth it out. Let's take about 3 minutes and see how much we get. But you're kind of stayed over which. By then we'll have stayed over 10 minutes. I don't need to. Now, just to show you what happened on mine, here was the first line here. I decided to kind of stick with that for the time being. So now that first line is on two lines. And it actually has a stronger feel about it now than it did when it was on a kind of lanky line. The line begins, Michael waded in Crane Creek. Now it's Michael waded in Crane Creek this way, and by smooshing it in that kind of way, I'm beginning to get some sounds nearer one another visually. Michael, Mike, okay, Creek. Okay. Now people will tell you sometimes, well, your poetry doesn't rhyme. You know? So obviously you're not working very hard. Well, I work very hard with that kind of stuff to get similar kinds of sounds. Why? Because there are rocks in the creek and other things, and there are crawdads that click when you drop into the pail, or bucket. So I'll probably use the word bucket because it has buck in it, and rock, and Crane Creek, and Michael, you know. I'll begin to hit those things a bit, you know, and sort of let the, that'll be the music of some of the piece, okay? And tomorrow I want to kind of talk about music a bit, but today I want to hand you a poem as a something to take home, and you don't have to write like me, but somebody asked earlier about the appearance of particular poems. I don't have books up here to sell or anything. That's not what I'm in the business of doing. But this was, I'll just hand this around. You can have this if you want it. If you don't want it, leave it here. Or write on the back of it, please, but don't wad it up. Okay, and then I'll just read this out loud, and then we'll go away. Now, anything that you have generated today or generate between today and tomorrow morning, that's kind of a short notice for us on the turnaround time here, or anything that you fix up into a position that you, what I'd like to begin with tomorrow is about 10 minutes or 15 of reading. You know, if we, I mean, it won't break my heart or kill me or anything, I mean, you know, I'll fall over if we don't do that, but that's kind of what I'm thinking will happen. And if it doesn't, well then, break my heart, no. Okay, so I'll just scan this here to see if there's a gloss that needs to happen. As with much of my stuff, the title came after much writing and rewriting of the poem. When we read poems, I find it helpful always to read it first on a literal level. What literally is happening? Okay? So if you'll listen to it in that way first, if we want to talk about it again, that's fine. But then after we get a literal take on it, we're pretty sure that we have a feel that we know what's going on literally, and then we can talk about you know, any kind of imagery or symbolism, etc., yada, yada, yada. I didn't realize that the word here was in the word heart until I wrote this title. And also I see that the three words begin with he, which I guess must be me. But I didn't know that. My daughter, bless her, is fascinated by her heart. She talks about it all the time. No, not all the time. At striking times, she brings it up, her heart. She'll skip around the house in time to music, holding her high hymn, halt at my elbow where I sit writing, and demand, "Feel my heart." I'm covering her whole chest with my one hand, I picture it, the size of the fist clenched at her arm's length. She smiles. She watches my face for recognition. Or another time, weeks later, after shampoo and floss and the story about the bear, she snuggles down among the quilts and her eyes find me in the dark. "Your heart," she says. "Sometimes you can feel it without hearing it because your hand can hear." You know, a couple of things that I'll mention to you that I hope will be helpful in your revising and revising. Between now and tomorrow. One of them is, it's important, I think, to try to begin and end lines. This has to do with line breaks. Try to begin and end lines with strong and or at least interesting words. Not words like the. Pardon? No, okay. One of the things that happens in this is not just a matter of alliteration. In word chunk 2, lines 3 and 4, it has holding her high hymn, halt. Of course, those all begin with that sound, but what is that sound? That's called an aspirant sound. Quick breath going out. This is one of the methods by which poets can get a lot of work done on a subliminal level at least, but if it's a worthy reader and has read a lot of poetry and so on, is, you know, on a more surface level too, where that's an aspirant sound, so by the time she gets to me, I don't have to say she was out of breath. Right. Because it's The child is panting by the time the child gets there. Okay. The word dark suggests death. This obviously has to do with more than just the incident of the floss and the bear and that kind of stuff, but the mortality of a child, the very heartbeat of a child, the fears of a parent for a child. None of us are that scared of our own death. We're not as scared of our own death as we are of our children's, I think. Okay, thanks. You waited around 15 minutes too long. I'm sorry about that. And I appreciate it. Oh, sure. Well, yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. Come and go as you like tomorrow, or or don't come if you don't like. But yeah, you can come later if you need, or come early, leave later, whatever you want.
Okay.
Sure. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Oh, sorry. See you tomorrow. You're rascals.
But I got a lot that I
got. Oh. Well, if you want to send anything along sometime, let me see what you're doing. I'm here.
How long are you?
Well, certainly through June. And right now, I hope another year or so after that. But maybe I'll hate the winter and not want that.
I may have one or two kids that would love to correspond.
Yeah, to you.
Great.
Cool. 10 pals.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Have a good trip.
Thank you.
I'm confused, although, what we were trying to do, I think.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I wrote about an event.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took out just segments of it, and it even makes the order.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of the middle was just to limit us in space, so it's more of a, is that the idea?
Yeah, so it's limit you in space, and also so it begins to give you a visual cue. Oh yeah, I'm writing a poem, and I want to have certain, I call it compression, but what I mean by that is not just editing out particular words, but maybe even changing syntaxes around so that I'm, I'm getting double duty out of words. I'm, et cetera. I mean, it's and that's what gives poetry its immediacy for us.
Yeah.
Is the fact that it's not prose. It's not sort of lying around, read at a pace, but it has an urgency about it, precisely because it's only got the stuff there that it has to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like if you're a serious hiker, you cut your toothbrush in half and leave the,
right.
You're just getting out of as slim a weight as you can, and that's what poetry is for me.
Yeah.
Just getting rid of all the excess baggage. So anyway, I don't know if it works
okay.
Or not, but we'll. And if you can come tomorrow, it'd be great to see you. And if you can't, I'll understand.
At 3:45?
Oh, no, tomorrow it's at 10:30.
Oh, I can't.
Okay, all right.
Can I borrow this?
Yeah, sure. Where's the page?
That's what I was looking for.
There it is. Yeah, it's one of those.
Do you want me to read you what I wrote there?
Yeah, sure.
Should I read what the whole thing and then read what I condensed?
Yeah, I better hear some of this and some of that. Thanks very much for coming. Thanks for the call.
I put, hello, balance failing. My mind is trembling. Hey Vince, how you doing? Yeah, the rope is right. Are my muscles up to this? Is my ego beyond this? I need a little slack. I'm coming down. I think I know a better way. Sliding? No, I don't think so. I could die right now. The rock is unforgiving, and I have asked for too much. Inches. All it takes is inches. Sliding slowly down, I reach my equilibrium. Feels good. I'm doing okay, Vince. Thanks. This is why.
That's great. I've got a lot of good information here. Okay, let's see the squeeze.
Balance failing. My mind is trembling. The rock is unforgiving. Have I asked for too much? My ego is beyond this. Sliding slowly down. I'm doing okay, thanks.
All right, see, we're getting a lot more pop and crackle in that.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't even hurt to have more. The rock is unforgiving might end up as almost being a title, but it might be Unforgiving Rock, or it might appear in the poem as Unforgiving Rock. Because it has that urgency of like, I'm thinking fast, I better decide now. And the subject really sort of demands that. It's not like I'm going to hang around here, monkeying with cracks, forever. I've got to, go up or down or sideways or something. Thank you very much. And so that kind of, I think that particular piece would benefit a lot from this kind of squeezing and squishing. Right. Uh-huh.
Well, I did have just Rock is Unforgiven, and I erased it, but the Rock is Unforgiven.
Yeah, I don't know. See what your taste tells you as you go along with it. You know?
Okay.
You see what happens. It's just all a big experiment. You know? It's just serious fun. Hell.
Nice to see you, Dad.
Nice to see you.